Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Guns are back before the Supreme Court. It's a big case, one that will steer the future of gun laws and gun control. At stake are basic questions about how the Bill of Rights is applied to states and localities across the nation. In particular, how states and localities can or cannot control guns. The High Court looks ready to overrule Chicago's gun ban. And what else? This hour, On Point, the Supreme Court wades deeper into the battle over guns. You can join the conversation. Should gun ownership be a basic, fundamental right no matter what, no matter where you live? What about states' rights? And are you concerned that a court decision could block local efforts to rein in gun violence? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The plaintiff in the case before the High Court, McDonald versus Chicago, is 76-year-old Otis McDonald. He's appealing Chicago's 28-year-old ban on handgun ownership. He told NPR yesterday he wants to own a gun to defend himself from young people and gang members who have broken into his house on Chicago's South Side three times.
Old people like myself, if we don't have some kind of deterrent in our homes, youngsters going to take anything they want to.
And here's Otis McDonald speaking with ABC News.
I know what my rights are, and I have an inherited right to own a gun in my own home.
I know what my rights are, says Otis McDonald, and the High Court is very likely to agree with him. Joining me first today from Washington is Jan Crawford, chief legal correspondent for CBS News, former legal affairs correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. She's author of Supreme Conflict, the inside story of the struggle for the United States Supreme Court. She was at the court yesterday for oral arguments in McDonald versus Chicago. Jan Crawford, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be back.
So I guess right off, the mystery goes away first. The court is almost certain to rule in favor of what, overturning the Chicago ban? Is that right?
You know, these were incredibly difficult arguments yesterday. In fact, I almost felt like I was back in law school taking some kind of, you know, sophisticated right. constitutional law seminar. But I do think, based on that hour-long argument, these justices, these five justices, the more conservative justices who were in the majority in that case 2 years ago, are going to say that the Second Amendment, you know, the right to keep and bear arms, is a fundamental right. And as a result, states and local governments can't infringe on that right. Now, that doesn't mean that states, and they made clear yesterday, too, that doesn't mean that they can't pass reasonable restrictions. It doesn't mean that guns will just, you know, flood the streets. But I do believe this court is poised to say that they can't flatly ban the kind of handguns that someone like Mr. McDonald in Chicago wants to keep in his home to defend himself.
Now, that was the effect of their ruling a couple of years ago in the District of Columbia. Why didn't that ruling already push back against Chicago's ban, let's say?
Well, that's why this case has gotten kind of so tied up and why these arguments are so complex yesterday. Of course, 2 years ago in that case in Heller, that was a landmark ruling for the first time ever. And it's really kind of incredible to think about it. You know, in the history of the Supreme Court, that issue really had never been squarely presented, whether the Second Amendment of the Constitution guarantees a person's right to own a gun in their home, or whether that is just so that, you know, as when the amendment passed, that was designed for militias. And the Supreme Court 2 years ago in that very contentious ruling said, yes, that guarantees an individual's right to keep and bear arms for protection in their homes. But that was a case involving the District of Columbia, which, of course, is a unique federal enclave. So now, after that ruling, people in the city of Chicago said, well, our gun ban, we have a fundamental right here in Chicago, and cities and states can't pass these kind of laws either. And so that's what the issue is before the court. It's not so much the policy issue anymore, but how broadly that landmark decision is going to be applied, and whether that amendment is going to restrain, if that amendment guarantees such a fundamental right that it's going to restrict and restrain the states from infringing on it, just like the other amendments in the Bill of Rights do. The First Amendment, for example, whether that just like those amendments are treated.
Freedom of speech. The Second Amendment, in short, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
But as you say, incredibly, it was only now, what, less than 2 years ago that was ruled by the Supreme Court to apply to the individual's right to bear arms. And with this case, what, they're going at not just the District of Columbia's, but any state, any locality's capacity to flatly ban that kind of ownership.
That's exactly right. And so what they have to decide is, again, whether or not the Second Amendment kind of is this the right to keep and bear arms, whether mm-hmm. that is a fundamental right, like the right to free speech. It's kind of, you know, when you think about it, and again, this is a lot of history. That's why I said it was like a con law seminar. Mm-hmm. But, you know, before the Civil War, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments, they didn't apply against the states. They only restrained the federal government. And then we had the 14th Amendment pass after the Civil War. And mm-hmm. then those rights were then restricting the states from infringing on people's rights as well.
That passed because after the Civil War, so many freed slaves and others were having their rights really, really stomped on for a while there.
Right, and the Supreme Court has ruled, and of course we had the 14th Amendment passed that said states can't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So, you know, the court has said that these other amendments would apply because states can't infringe on people's rights without due process of law. And so this amendment now, what they're going to decide mm-hmm. is whether the Second Amendment falls in line with all those other amendments in the Bill of Rights. And I think, again, from those arguments, the justices are poised to say that, yes, the Second Amendment does guarantee a fundamental right, and states can't infringe it any more than the federal government can.
Well, look at gun rights and gun control, but we've also got all kinds of wrinkles and peculiarities here, not least this is now a conservative court. And conservatives have traditionally been very strong in defending states' rights, whereas here they're looking to override those rights when it comes to gun control.
Well, I wouldn't look at it that way. And I think that, you know, as Justice Scalia said yesterday, look in the Constitution. The Constitution says a right to keep and bear arms. And so what they're doing is trying to decide the parameters of that right and how broadly it could be applied. And the lawyer for Mr. McDonald argued quite sweepingly. He advanced this a novel argument that would really force the court to overturn about 140 years of case law. And the justices did not look like they were going to go there at all. In fact, the Chief Justice yesterday said that, you know, really rejecting that approach and that would give judges much more leeway. So I think what we're going to see from this court is that this right is fundamental, but it's still going to give states a lot of leeway, not judges, states and legislatures and local governments, a lot of leeway to impose reasonable restrictions on gun ownership. You can't flatly ban them, mm-hmm. but you can certainly pass reasonable restrictions on gun ownership.
We'll look at due process and privileges and immunities here, but let's go first to this issue of gun rights, gun control. Jan Crawford, please stand by in Washington. Joining us right now from Providence, Rhode Island, is Carl Bogus. He's an expert on the Second Amendment, gun rights, and gun control policy, professor of law at Roger Williams University. He edited the Second Amendment in Law and History. Historians and constitutional scholars on the right to bear arms. Carl Bogus, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be here.
So we can all see where the court appears to be headed. Talk to us first about the likely impact of this on state and local gun regulation if the court overturns Chicago in this case.
The impact short term is limited. It will, if the court does what Jan Crawford suggests it will, and I agree with her, that it almost certainly the court will find that the right to bear arms is incorporated and therefore applies against the states. It will overturn gun regulations in Chicago and possibly in New York City. There are profound ramifications long term, and they are these. Jan Crawford pointed out that the Supreme Court has said that while the Second Amendment protects a right to own a handgun in one's home, reasonable restrictions may still be permitted and that there's a lot of leeway.
Mm-hmm.
But the question really is, what are reasonable restrictions and what leeway matters? And here's why I think this will have potentially profound ramifications permanently.
Okay.
There are a lot of data as to whether gun control works, and we know that it does. but only one kind. And by when I say works, I mean does it reduce homicides, robberies, aggravated assaults,
right,
and suicides? Does it make a difference in the real world? The only kind that appears to make a difference are regulations that restrict, reduce the number of handguns, not all guns, handguns in general circulation.
Mm-hmm.
It may well be that under the Heller rubric, that that kind of regulation is unconstitutional. And maybe the what will be barred will be the effective forms of gun control and the cosmetic forms, often described as reasonable restrictions,
right,
will be permitted. So we'll be left with only
the stuff that doesn't work.
Yes, elixir and not real medicine.
In your view.
Yes.
Elixir, not real medicine. Jan, any hint of that before the court yesterday in the hall?
Well, you know, they were very careful even in Heller to talk about some of those reasonable restrictions, concealed weapons, for example, and those kind of things. But we didn't really get a sense from these arguments about what the parameters of this ruling were going to be in terms of, you know, the guidance they would give to lower courts or to state and local governments about what which restrictions would or would not be reasonable.
We'll come back
yesterday. They were grappling with how to do the bigger issues.
We'll look at those big issues, Jan, and what the likely fallout is for gun ownership, gun rights, gun control. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the United States Supreme Court wading deeper into gun laws and likely to rein in how cities and states can control guns. We've been talking with Jan Crawford, chief legal correspondent for CBS News, and it's great to have her back with us, always really clear in laying out the issues before the court, and with Carl Bogus at Roger Williams University. He's a big expert on gun control policy. You just heard him say that he fears, from his perspective, that this will outlaw ultimately is just the effective kind of gun control. Of course, there's all kinds of controversy around that. We're joined right now from Fairfax Station, Virginia, by Nelson Lund, professor of constitutional law and the Second Amendment at George Mason University. He served as associate counsel for President George H.W. Bush. He's a defender of Second Amendment rights. Clerk for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Nelson Lund, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
First, you may have just heard Carl Bogus's interpretation of where we're headed here. You know, that reasonable restrictions may still be allowed by this court, in this court's view, but he fears that what will be disallowed will be the only kind of restrictions which are, in his view, effective in reducing gun violence, that is, reducing the sort of number of handguns in circulation.
Well, I think he's factually wrong on that. I think that's just mistaken. There's a lot of evidence showing that bans or restrictions on the general population of that kind are exactly what don't work. The only kinds of gun control that work, in his sense of the word, mm-hmm. are those that keep guns out of the hands of that portion of the population, that small portion of the population that's particularly prone to violence and crime.
I know it's impossible to know at this point, but as you listened yesterday to the arguments before the court, and you look at this court from Heller to this McDonald case, where do you see the court coming down on the kinds of restrictions, reasonable restrictions, that they are likely to permit when it's all said and done?
Well, you can't tell from the oral argument because they didn't discuss it. There are quite a few hints in the Heller opinion from 2 years ago.
Okay.
It looks as though they're going to be quite cautious in striking down gun control laws of the type that we're mostly familiar with. They gave a few examples of things that they would uphold. They were what's in legal terms called dicta. They're not binding, but indicated where their thinking is, that they're going to be quite generous in allowing the government to regulate guns. Now, they didn't answer all questions, and there are a lot of important questions that are left open. We'll have to see how that turns out in litigation down the road.
But when we look at things we're familiar with, the gun registration or limits on who's eligible to own a gun or whether the actual carrying can be regulated, does the court appear ready to liberalize those laws or to stick with regulation like that?
Very hard to tell. They specifically said that laws forbidding the concealed carry of firearms would be okay, but they said absolutely nothing about carrying guns openly in public. They just said nothing, and conspicuously said nothing about that. They also said that the government could ban guns in what they called sensitive places, but they only gave two examples and no guidance at all about how the courts will go about deciding what places are sensitive and what places are not sensitive. Another kind of gun control regulation that they didn't talk at all about in the Heller case are the types of regulations that can kind of licensing and registration requirements. Some of those, clearly they're going to uphold some, those that they regard as reasonable, and I think a very important area for future litigation is going to be, well, when do those licensing and registration requirements become so onerous as to amount to an undue restriction on the rights of gun owners? If you set up a process that makes it almost impossible to get a license, that's in effect banning it. And where will the line be drawn between reasonable requirements of that type and those that go too far?
Carl Bogus, what kind of new horizon of gun control policy do you see coming in the signals so far in Heller and McDonald from this court?
Well, the Supreme Court did give some hint as to what it considers to be sensitive places where guns could be banned. It did say schools and government buildings. And it may be worth noting that when they include government buildings, I think we can be pretty sure that the Supreme Court is going to ban guns in the Supreme Court.
In the actual building of the court. Well,
absolutely.
Okay,
so I my guess is they don't want to go to a workplace where people are armed, but they're going to be willing to send the rest of us, not members of Congress in a government building, but the rest of us to workplaces, perhaps where people are armed, perhaps not, because they may restrict the right of gun ownership, the constitutionally protected right, to the home alone. So I don't think that the decision is going to create, except in D.C. and Chicago and any other major city, perhaps New York, which has laws presently in effect that are ruled unconstitutional and terminated, I don't think we'll see immediate change elsewhere in the country.
But what are you saying? Are you just being facetious when you're saying they don't want guns in their workplace? Are you suggesting Americans are going to go to work at the other end of this tunnel and everybody, it's going to look like Deadwood, everybody with a six gun on their hip?
I'm not entirely being facetious, I've forgotten the columnist that recently wrote a column that said members of Congress who keep talking about the fact that conservative members of Congress keep talking about the fact that more guns make people safer. Well, if you believe that, then allow guns in Congress.
Jan, what's your reading here, Jan? Do you see this headed toward a United States of America with a much more open, you know, gun ownership and gun carrying? Is that,
you know, Tom, one of the things that surprised me throughout all of this litigation, though, are how many states that actually allow guns. There are very few cities across the country that have these kind of bans that Chicago does. Oak Park, Evanston, there's just a handful. And it's always surprising, I think, when you hear the National Rifle Association talking about, you know, these severe restrictions on gun ownership. They're really aren't that many. I mean, as Nelson points out, some of the what we're going to see, I think, and where you're going to see a lot of the challenges are in registration requirements. And I think waiting periods is going to be a real source of controversy and a very difficult question for the lower courts to resolve.
You mean how long you have to wait while your background is checked on?
That's exactly right. Because you could see, say, a woman who is being a victim of domestic abuse or is, feels like she's being stalked or threatened, saying that I have to have this handgun now to protect myself, mm-hmm. and I have a fundamental right to that gun. Those mm-hmm. are going to be, I think, difficult questions. The other questions, as both Carl and Nelson points out, Heller did give us many clues about some of those reasonable restrictions. Assault weapons bans, for example, I think mm-hmm. will continue to be upheld. But when you think about, as our, the other two have discussed, I mean, some of those registration questions and, again, waiting periods, I think that's a difficult issue.
Nelson Lund, do you have any sense of where we're headed here? I guess it depends how you define severe, but do you see a question mark now over registration, waiting periods, assault weapon bans? Are those now in question? Might they be pushed aside in this tide?
Well, I think all of those things are in question in the legal sense, and the courts haven't decided them. Jan is right that one of the characteristics of gun control in this country is that it's been rare for any government to impose, you know,
blanket
real
restrictions,
strong
mm-hmm.
restrictions or bans on people, and therefore I don't expect to see much in the way of life changing for most Americans, because most Americans do not and have never suffered under really draconian types of gun control regulations. So, but at the margins, I think there will be a lot of interesting litigation, and some significant number of people will be affected, as they already have been in Washington, D.C.
I guess a lot of it is about what you consider the margins. Let's go to our listeners. Davenport, Iowa, Toby. Toby, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just had a quick question in regards to what is the current standard. I feel that many Americans at this time don't know what the current constitutional standards allow as far as if people can have a gun, for instance, in their apartment or in a condo, say, that they own that is in the same building as other people, or even perhaps in an RV that is moving along the interstate. And I'll take my answer out the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Toby. Carl?
Well, I think the Supreme Court has made it clear that there is a constitutional right for individuals to have handguns in their homes. Past that, nothing is clear.
Nelson, I have a feeling you'd paint a broader free zone.
Well, I think it's going to turn out to be broader than that, but how much broader? I agree with Carl, is unclear.
But didn't we, for example, Jan, there was the national park. You can have guns in national parks, for example, now, if I'm not mistaken.
You know, and this is, again, I mean, when you talk about, you know, as the caller just said, it's incredibly confusing, and that's what this court is going to have to decide, what the exact right is. And I agree with Carl and Nelson, as we've been talking for the past half hour, that this court is going to say the Second Amendment is a fundamental right and that people do have a right to keep a gun in their home.
Apartment building or house doesn't really matter, does it? Or am I wrong?
No, that's saying exactly. That's mm-hmm. your home. Mm-hmm. Now, an RV, I don't know if I would go that far. But there's also, you know, there are also many states allow you to carry guns, to carry guns
sure.
openly. And
mm-hmm.
those restrictions, I think, any kind of restrictions on that, this court may also say are not allowed, which, of course, is different than to conceal carry, which they've suggested will not be challenged. Those bans can continue.
Nelson, what about it? Do you expect open carry to spread here? More states will or will have to allow the open carrying of weapons?
Well, we've already seen a tremendous spread in laws starting in the late 1980s in laws allowing law-abiding citizens to carry concealed weapons. And that has coincided with decline in crime across a bigger decline of crime in those states than in the states that forbid it. So I think the future is probably legislatures deciding correctly, in my view, that allowing law-abiding citizens to carry concealed weapons is a good idea. How the court will decide about open carry restrictions, I think, remains a complete mystery. And they just have given no hint about that. But they're in a little bit of a bind. If they say that concealed carry can be forbidden and open carry can be completely banned,
yeah.
when the Constitution gives you a right to keep and bear arms. And I think that's why they haven't addressed that question, because it's going to be a little hard to forbid open carry and be consistent with the language of the Constitution.
Let's go to Albany, New York, and Pete. Pete, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you think,
just
Pete?
A quick comment.
Yeah.
I've been a lifetime NRA member. I think there's a profound misunderstanding of the Constitution. When the states ratified the Bill of Rights, they all basically signed on to it. And the Bill of Rights is there to protect individual and collective freedoms, like the right to assemble and free speech. That's both an individual and a collective freedom. And so is the Second Amendment. I mean, it's not only an individual freedom, it's a collective freedom if I go and hunt with my buddies.
I mean, so you say, but isn't it interesting, Pete, that it's only now in 2010 that this is being nailed down, 2008 earlier?
Well, I think what's happened here is over the decades, for whatever reason, the society, there's been a strong anti-gun movement, and the justices haven't been too conservative in their thinking and too conservative in upholding the Bill of Rights. And now is probably the time to bring it up for an issue with all the draconian drug gun laws that are out there in different cities and states.
Yeah. Pete, thanks for your call. Carl, how about it? Why now do you see this coming up? Is it just because of the tides of politics here that brought George W. Bush into office, that changed the face of the Supreme Court? I mean, here we are, you know, a couple centuries plus into the country's history, and we're just getting around to nailing this down?
Well, it's an interesting story of law and politics and legal politics. So the consensus view throughout the late 19th and the 20th century up until Heller was that the Second Amendment granted people the right to keep and bear arms only within the militia, and that is the militia defined elsewhere in the Constitution that is under the joint control of the federal and state governments and organized by Congress. Today, that's the National Guard system. Mm. And the reason that was the consensus view is the Second Amendment begins with the preamble. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And there were a couple of Supreme Court cases, three actually, the most recent in 1938, and although they had some ambiguity to them, 9 out of 11 federal courts of appeals that read them said that they only granted the right, basically, of states to have armed militias, not an individual right. What changed was politics and the composition of the court and the desire of particularly libertarians, the Cato Institute, to take this to the court. I believe that the National Rifle Association was reluctant to take this to the court. They had the best of both worlds. They could rail against the fact that the courts were not interpreting the Second Amendment to be an individual right. They could stir up fear among members. They could raise a lot of money. And they were, I think, reluctant to go and get and either lose or get a victory that might reduce their ability to gin up passion in their constituency.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court wading deeper into gun laws. And with a conservative cast, a lot of changes may be afoot here. Jan Crawford's here from CBS News, Carl Bogus from Roger Williams University, and Nelson Lund from George Mason University. Patrick in Charlottesville, Virginia. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Really appreciate your show. I have a very general observation to make, which I've never heard anybody make in one of these discussions.
Okay.
Which has to do with history and changes in technology and changes in society. If we imagine in 1789, when the Constitution was written, an insane person breaking into a tavern with a firearm and opening fire on the crowd, what happens?
It's a musket.
He has one shot, one bullet.
Okay.
Then the crowd overpowers him and disarms him. So the firearms have changed, and we already set limits on the private person's ability to own arms. You're not allowed to own a grenade launcher or a piece of artillery or a howitzer. It's just the question here is, where is the limit going to be set? So in 1789, a private citizen couldn't wreak havoc in a public place. He only had one shot.
And now we've got very, very powerful weapons out there. Interesting. Thank you, Patrick. Nelson Lund, what do you say to that?
Well, there are some. There certainly have been a lot of important changes in technology. I don't think they confirm the caller's point, though.
The point being you could kill a lot more people in 60 seconds today than you could when the Constitution was written?
That's right, because at that time there were shotguns, and they can kill a lot of people as quickly as most modern, typical civilian arms.
I don't know. I mean, an assault rifle and they can kill a few, but still, if it's one shot at a time, that is different, isn't it?
Well, I was about to say they also had grenades at that time, and they were unregulated. So, if somebody was determined to do mass killings at that time, they could use grenades. The other thing that's changed is our medical technology has also improved quite dramatically. So it's actually a large percentage of people who are shot with the kind of handguns that are involved in so many crimes actually survive. You can also see a similar phenomenon with some of these mass shootings where people have used so-called assault weapons. A surprisingly high percentage of the people who are shot survive.
You might be shot, but you survive, perhaps, so it's okay? Is that the logic?
I'm not saying it's okay. I'm saying that at the same time the technology of firearms has changed, so has medical technology, transportation technology, and so there are some offsetting effects, none of which has much to do, I think, with the real question, which is whether people have a right to defend themselves against crime. I mean, to say that, and it doesn't do the potential victims of these kinds of shootings one bit of good to take guns away from the people that might defend them when the criminals won't obey these kinds of laws anyway. So these kinds of laws that purport to ban handguns don't take one single handgun out of the hand of any determined criminals.
Jan, do you see the technology question coming into the court's consideration here at all, as our caller appears to hope it might?
Well, certainly. And I mean, I think in Heller we saw some clues that the federal assault weapons ban is not going to be struck down, even though the Second Amendment confers a individual right to keep and bear arms. You know, I think that there still will be restrictions on certain types of bullets that can be very dangerous, the so-called cop killer bullets. But again, this goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago and what is and is not a reasonable restriction. But on some of those aggressive killing machines, those weapons, I think from Heller we do have some clues that the court will allow some of those restrictions.
Shane in New Britain, Connecticut. Shane, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going? I love the show.
Thank you.
So I hear a lot about the slippery slope being used, and I hate that argument, but I find it intriguing in this context. I own guns, and I've owned guns my whole life. I've been an avid hunter. I've actually owned handguns in the past. The thing that I see is I think if you want to have a weapon in your home, I think that's great. But, I mean, at the end of all of this conversation about restriction and what's right and what's wrong, I have this weird fear that I'm going to end up worried about having, you know, angry parents at my kid's soccer game with guns, or guys in a bar starting fights with guns. Mm. Or, I mean, it's going to make customer service at the mall a totally different proposition.
Carl Bogus, what do you say to that? I mean, we have seen changes lately. Virginia, the General Assembly not long ago, you know, approved a bill that would allow people to carry concealed weapons in bars and restaurants that serve alcohol. Where do you think we're headed on that front, Carl?
Well,
outside the home, that is.
Yes. Contrary to what many people imagine, most shootings do not occur in the course of crimes such as robberies. They occur in the course of arguments. The best data, although it's a little bit it's a little bit slippery here because we don't always know who a murderer was. But the best data suggests that only about 7% of murders occur during crimes, and that most of them are occurring during arguments and brawls. Brawls in barrooms and lovers' quarrels and domestic disputes and road rage. And Shane is quite right to be worried about some, you know, insane or drunk parent who is in rage and can't control himself at a kid soccer game. Shooting somebody, because that is what happens.
Jan, is that where we're headed, though, here? I mean, there has been this chasm for a long, long time, gun rights advocates versus others saying, why can't we be, you know, the United States be more like other countries where there are not guns all over the place? For a time, I think that gun control segment felt hopeful that maybe somehow there'd be a kind of mopping up. Do you feel big turn in another direction here?
No, I don't. And I think that the idea that, you know, some yuppie parent's going to take a, you know, handgun to a soccer game because his kid's not getting playing time is really, it's absurd. I mean, this,
why
keep
is
in
that
mind
absurd? Look at the news stories.
Because this is a case, well, you could do that now. I mean, that's an illegal act. Mm-hmm, and this is a case, you know, I mean, a parent could do that now. I mean, this is a case about whether someone like Mr. McDonald, mm-hmm, an elderly man in a dangerous neighborhood, can have a handgun to protect himself in his home, mm-hmm, when guns are rampant in this country. Guns are in the hands of criminals in this country, mm-hmm, as Mr. McDonald well knows. And that is what this case is about. People can get access to guns in an illegal way, just like they, you know, have done, and just like we've seen tragedies across this nation. But this is a question about whether law-abiding citizens can have access to guns to protect themselves.
Nelson Lund, here's a comment from Facebook from Scott, who says, how come people on the right, the conservative side of the political spectrum, are so into states' rights until states start doing things they don't like ban guns or allow same-sex marriage? What do you say to that, Professor Lund?
Well, I'm not going to speak for anybody else, but the Constitution gives certain powers to the federal government, certain powers to the states, and I think the conservative position, which is my position, is that the federal government should only exercise the powers the Constitution gives it, and the states should be allowed to exercise the powers that they're given by the Constitution of the United States and their own state constitutions. And the only question is which powers have been assigned in which places.
But isn't that exactly what we're talking about?
By the constitutions.
But isn't that just what we're talking about in this case? Whether...
Right, but my point is you should decide the question by looking at the law, not by looking at what you like.
Though courts have been considering this for a long time, and it's only now that the federal overrule of a local gun law outside the District of Columbia is coming into question.
Well, that's right, and the reason that that's true is largely the reason that that we talked about earlier, which is that gun control has been relatively light in this country, so it didn't tend to generate much litigation.
Colonel Bogus, do you see an irony here in what? And you know, I don't have the nuance of a law professor, but it can look from a distance like the folks who would have been protectors of state rights now saying no, not when it comes to guns.
Yes, I think there is an irony because I think that liberals have always read the Second Amendment as a federalism provision that protects the rights of states to have armed militias irrespective of what Congress may decide, so that they can have armed militias to preserve their own security no matter what Congress would decide, which is ironic because you would consider that to be the conservative position, protecting states' rights. If I can, I'd like to come back to something that that Jan Crawford said about keeping about drawing a distinction between law-abiding citizens and keeping allowing law-abiding citizens like the plaintiff here, Otis McDonald, to have weapons and not others. The problem is, and by the way, I do agree with her. I do want to say this. I do agree with her that nothing that the Supreme Court is doing is going to increase murders in the country. What it's going to do is decrease the ability of states and localities to deal with murders and to try to reduce them. But what I want to say is that, unfortunately, this idea that if we can just keep guns out of the wrong hands, arm the responsible citizens and disarm the irresponsible citizens, that is not, unfortunately, possible in the real world. And that many people who misuse guns, whether they're high school students in Columbine, Colorado, or a military physician at Fort Hood, were law-abiding citizens up until the time they misused guns. And what I am suggesting is that there is medicine that is available that will reduce murders and reduce armed robberies and aggravated assaults and suicides. And we know what that is, and it is what Nelson refers to as draconian regulations, and I refer to as effective regulations, that is, regulations that severely restrict handguns in general circulation.
But are those now off limits? What you call effective medicine, is the court between Heller and where it seems to be Heller McDonald putting those off limits?
It appears that it may be. And by the way, in the little clip by Otis McDonald in the beginning, he said, I want a gun in my home for self-protection. In fact, Chicago allowed him a gun in his home for self-protection, a long gun, a rifle, and not a handgun. That was Chicago's decision to restrict handguns, because it is handguns that are the elephant in the room. It is handguns that are responsible for 60% of all murders in the country, where long guns, rifles and shotguns, which are more prevalent, are responsible only for 7%.
Harder to pull that out from under the bed, I guess. Julian in Boston. Julian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks very much for having me on. Yeah. I have a lot to say, and I'll try to make it quick. I'm very excited to be on. I just wanted to dovetail some of those statistics that were just mentioned before I make my point. I'm an attorney, and I've written a couple law review notes that have to do with the ability of the private sector, namely civil products liability-based lawsuits, to help bolster some of the protections that we could see in the future that would protect the public from the handguns. And what I just wanted to say was the statistics that I found, sure, handguns responsible for 60% of homicides, and of those homicides, less than 2% on an average yearly basis of those homicides are considered legally justifiable, which means that the vast majority, you know, more than 90% of the handgun murders in this country are criminal. And what it brings to mind is the efficacy of handguns in the marketplace as a product. And, you know, there was a famous car manufacturer that manufactured a car that blew up every time somebody rear-ended it.
Yeah, but handguns are supposed to kill people. I hate to put it that way, but I mean, that's the threat that they're supposed to carry, isn't it?
But I'm saying that imagine if we had a constitutional right to another product that was as harmful as this particular product. And my question is, people demand a right to own these things. Fine. But at what point in time does the harm that they cause in our society outweigh the benefit to those that would say, I'm a strict constructionist, we must have a right to this product?
But if Ford Pinto ownership was right there in the Constitution as a right or some kind of it, I mean, how could you, I don't know, Jan, is there a product liability line that could open up here as another way toward getting some kind of controls on?
No, I don't see that, although I think some of the liberals on the court would try to advance that argument. We saw Justice Breyer, for example, yesterday talking about some of these statistics and how you know, states and local governments would have or should have the right to come in and say, you know, guns kill and we can restrict them, that that is a more compelling interest than guaranteeing that a person has a right to self-defense. But I don't see five justices on this court taking that approach. And, you know, also, I mean, you say guns kill and that's the purpose of them, but keep in mind guns are also a deterrent. I mean, I grew up in rural Alabama, and I can, where police are 30 miles away. Now, there are no gun bans there, of course. But, you know, people know you've got a gun in your house. Somebody's not going to break in. That's a deterrent.
Well, that's
and
my
I think
point.
That's
the
also
threat,
what
the
Mr. McDonald
harm.
Is talking mm-hmm. about. He may never mm-hmm. use that gun, mm-hmm. but when people know that they can protect themselves with it, that's also an important aspect of gun ownership.
We've only got a minute left, but there was a wider question here which the court didn't even want to get into yesterday on due process and privileges or immunities and where everybody comes down on how you take constitutional law out to the states. It looks as though that's not going to be a box that gets opened up in this case, Jen.
No, absolutely not. None of the justices, the conservatives, look like they wanted to go in that first clause, the privileges and immunities clause, which would require them to overturn a case that's 140 years old. Justice Scalia was scoffing at that. In fact, that was the question. The privilege and immunities clause, when I took the bar exam, they told us when we were studying for that, if you see that as an answer, don't pick it because it's never used. The court never uses it, and they're not going to do that in this case. They're going to rule, I believe, that this is a fundamental right and that states can't deprive people of their Second Amendment right, a liberty interest, without the due process of law.
A new era rolls on this court. Jan Crawford with CBS News, author of Supreme Conflict. It's always great to have you with us. Thank you very much for being
Thanks,
with us today,
Tom.
Jen. Nelson Lund at George Mason University, thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Lund.
Thank you for having me.
And Carl Bogus at Roger Williams University in Providence, Rhode Island. Thank you for joining us, Professor Bogus.
It was a pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.